Welcome to the Disrupt Education Podcast. Allie, I got to tell you, at the recording of this podcast, it's the first time I've seen the sun in probably 800 days. I don't know. I'm exaggerating. It might be 80, though.
Yes, this El Nino winter has certainly been a mix of cloudiness, even like in places that don't typically see a lot of clouds. My uncle in Arizona was talking about that Arizona is known for, like, especially the Phoenix area, like 350 days of sunshine. And I think they've hit, like, you know, clouds way more than normal. But
good for them. I'm not upset.
Yeah, all those Arizonans, their warm weather. But I saw the sun in January. We're recording this at the end of January. And right. But I was in New York teaching an intensive.
And how'd that wrap up?
It was amazing. This is my second year doing that. And, you know, just kind of like, I don't know exactly where this episode's going to go. However, I do think that one of the things I love about teaching it is that students have a lot of ownership in where their learning takes them in this particular course on, like, science literacy. And just to kind of plug, like, the power of students picking a topic within an educational environment is really, really powerful for them to kind of dive into and explore their interests in. And just as, like, a practice in any level in education, is that like, ownership of the material is so transformative, and was really powerful to see where students took their learning in that course. So
I'm going to attach, you know, with that, we're coming at you with the CAPS Network president and executive director, which means he's got to do a lot of stuff, but he made time for us today. Corey Moen is here with us. Corey, how are you, man?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing?
We're doing wonderful. You know, kind of going along with Allie and the ownership, talking about that at the collegiate level, it's very interesting because, you know, we've talked to Nate Clayburgh before, but you know, kind of digging into the education to employment pathways and then how to's, who, what, when, where. Well, guess what? I think you have that network. Well, first, before we jump into that, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself, man. What was your education path, and then how did you wind up leading this, well, this awesome network that's going to connect community, employment, and education?
Yeah, no, I appreciate being on the show, first of all, and I also appreciate that question. And it can be a very long and dramatic story. And we don't have enough time, even within the 45 minutes or so that we're going to record today, to get to all of it. But I definitely will summarize it for you. But I'd also like to say it's also sunny in where I'm sitting in Kansas City.
There we go.
Both physically and emotionally, because our sports team, the Chiefs, just got clinched a berth to the Super Bowl. So it's
right.
A glorious day to be in Kansas City. The weather is cooperating. The sports team's cooperating. Everyone's in a good mood. So it's like you planned perfectly. Wow. The timing of having me on here, because you're going to get 100% of my energy.
And that's what we knew. That's what we do with Disruptor.
So good.
Notice our colors for Disruptor, very close to the two Super Bowl teams. Now, when this comes out, they'll probably be a Super Bowl champion, but they will have the same colors as the Disrupt Education podcast.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, you've done a nice job. But no, Corey Moen, you mentioned my official title, but I like to talk about myself as the chief cheerleader for CAPS Network and all things profession-based learning, which is, you know, it's a term we use to describe this deeper interaction for high school students going through a self-discovery process and using the lens of industry as a way to try out and rule out, you know, and really learn about, you know, as a student, let me learn about myself so that I can, you know, when I exit out of high school and I'm making decisions that affect my time and my finances and my happiness, quite honestly, or my joy that I get in life, that we can maximize and optimize those decisions. That's really important. And so that's kind of, you know, what we do, just kind of at a very, you know, in a very broad view, but it relates to my own story of kind of how I got here and who I am. You know, my growing up, I was always interested in my school experience was a very positive experience. But looking back, it was very, very regimented. Mm-hmm. There was choice, but it was limited. And it was, in some cases, it was choice in terms of maybe some topics to explore, disciplines to explore through classes. It did not allow for any real exploration outside of the school walls. And, you know, as I have been out and about and across the country, both working directly with our CAPS Network affiliates, which we'll probably talk more about later, but also just out in the ecosystem, the broader ecosystem of schools and K-12, the good news is there's a lot more opportunities for students to get out and to do things that are unique and interesting. The bad news is it's a very small percentage still. And a lot of what I see when I move around could have been me in a time machine going back to when I was in high school, which is a scary thought because that was, you know, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So my journey, you know, I got through high school and had a good experience. And I was very much like the person that played school. I wanted to get the best grades and I don't want to say conform, but I wanted to achieve. And I played that game well, which on one hand was great. You got what you needed to get to the next level. On the other hand, I was intentionally, now that I reflect back on it, I was intentionally avoiding opportunities to learn that might have negatively impacted my GPA, my class rank, whatever. So it was kind of this playing it safe thing, which, you know, ultimately I've learned didn't do me any favors. And oh, by the way, not a single person ever in my life has asked me what my GPA was in high school.
We're asking now, what was it?
I couldn't tell you. I'm not sure what they mean, what GPAs mean anyway, because they're all, every district does it differently. True. And you can't even keep things within, there's no 100%, like there's no 4.0 because there's a 4.2 or a 4.4. I don't even know what it means. But at the time it seemed really important, right? It seemed really important. And in talking to current high school students, they are obsessed with this and trying to do what they think they need to do without any context to the broader world and what it really means and what people are really going to expect from you, which I would categorize as durable skills, right? That's ultimately what gets you successful in any lane you want to be in. If you can communicate, if you can manage a project, if you can show up on time, if you can look people in the eye and shake their hand and, you know, do the follow-up you need to do, curate relationships and social capital, like that stuff is important regardless of what you go into. So anyway, I get to college. I have a great experience there. I'm still playing school. It's harder to play school there, but I still played it. I got out into the real world, had no freaking clue what I wanted to do with my life. I got into a role that was in the professional world that was city planning and economic development related, and ended up enjoying a lot of aspects of that. Started a business when I was 23 that kind of dug into that a little bit more, found a little niche market that we could serve. And I learned so much doing that. The process of starting a business broke me from perfectionism. Because you absolutely could not tee everything up the way you wanted. And if you tried to, your business was going to go under. You had to move, you had to act, you had to make calculated decisions. And sometimes they didn't work. And that was okay because you learned quickly and then you moved on. But it finally woke me up as a human being and kind of a work professional, like why it's important to iteratively move through kind of decision making and to have that growth mindset and that kind of lean startup model in your head at all times. So where I'm going with all this is I never thought I would work in education. My parents are both educators and they told me from the time I was little that I was going to be a teacher or I was going to work in school or I was going to be an administrator. And it was just destined that that was where I needed to be. And of course, as a kid, you just stiff arm your parents as much as you possibly can. So I'm like, I'm going to not do that. I'm not doing that. I've got other things I want to do. And so for, you know, I was in my mid to late 30s, and they finally kind of gave up on me. And I was like, okay, this feels much better. Like I can do my thing. I started working for some organizations that supported other businesses and entrepreneurs, helped them start and grow businesses, helped them find resources. I was funding some startups for the state of Kansas and the state of Kansas and the Kansas City area. And that felt really good. And I enjoyed it. And then right about the time I felt like I had everything right where I wanted it, you know, whether you call it God or spirit or universe or whatever you want to call it, decided to play a joke on me and drop what seemed to be the most amazing opportunity in my lap when I wasn't looking for a job. And it was to go into high school level program, basically go into a high school level program and bring all of these skills and experiences and mainly connections, really, mm-hmm. to high school students that were in this really innovative model called CAPS. And it was just fascinating enough to me. And it seemed like such amazing impact that could be made that I just couldn't resist going for it, thinking there's no way they're going to hire an entrepreneur turned public servant to go into education and run a program when he has no certification in education, no degree in education. And I was wrong. They decided that they wanted me. And so for the last 9 years, that's what I've been doing. And it's been a lot of fun. And I think the key takeaway for me is I lived without knowing it. I lived the CAPS experience because I was on a journey of self-discovery. Mm-hmm. It took me until I was starting at CAPS, which was into my late 30s, early 40s, to truly get it, that's what happened. But now having that context and perspective, being able to work with 16, 17, 18-year-olds and have them start that process much earlier, they can avoid some of the, you know, tough times that I had, mm-hmm. thinking that I knew what I wanted to do and then finding out that that really wasn't the reason or the motivation. No. So excited to be with you and talk more about CAPS and to answer any questions you have and to be in conversation with you. I'm excited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with the CAPS program and, you know, what it looks like on kind of just like the high level overview, bird's eye view, kind of break that down for us and the listeners to kind of like, what, you know, why did we even bring someone? What is CAPS? You know, like, who does it serve and why would it be disruptive in the traditional educational model?
For sure. Yeah. So I always talk about, when I talk about CAPS, I typically lead with the kind of slogan for the program, which is we go where students lead. So if you think philosophically about what would school look like if we were always asking the question, what would it mean for students to lead in whatever this activity is or in whatever learning we're trying to accomplish? It's kind of a complete flip of the way we've done school for more than a century. You know, for decades and decades, it's we have someone at the front of the room that has a level of expertise and a certification. You're here to learn whatever these units or standards are, and this is the person that's the expert. What we're saying is we believe that there's more power in the students leading it with their curiosity and helping to bring the expertise, the knowledge of what's happening out in the real world back to not just them, obviously to themselves, but back to their peers and back to their instructor, who serves very much like a facilitator or a manager of a company, right? We talk a lot about students as consultants. We believe very strongly that there's a lot of power and empowerment for students to serve as consultants to businesses and nonprofits. And if they have an interest in a certain segment, whether it's health and medicine or it's engineering or it's technology or it's teacher education or law or biosciences, you know, you name it, there are all these different industry sectors. You know, some of them are for profit, some of them are nonprofit, or maybe it's entrepreneurship. Maybe it's, you know, getting to know what it means to live the startup life. All those explorations, there are these windows and lanes, but giving the students the chance, not just to hear what it's like, not just to, you know, do some research about what does it mean to be in this profession or, you know, what are the things that are happening out in the world today? That's great. But let's get them out where they're actually doing it. Like the best way to know whether something is for you or not for you, and also to learn how to do something, is to just try to do it. I had a great conversation with a good friend of mine, Dr. Chris Unger, who teaches at Northeastern University. And he had this conversation with me, and I kept wondering, what in the world is he trying to get me to say here? But he was being facetious, but he basically was walking me through this exercise of, hey, remember when you were little and you learned how to ride a bike? He goes, my guess is your parents gave you a book to read that said, you know, this is how you ride a bike. And you read the book and then you got on the bike and you rode it. And I said, no, of course not. And he goes, oh, so did they like, okay. So they probably like showed you like a movie or a TV show that showed someone riding a bike. And so you watched them ride a bike and then you got on the bike and you rode the bike. I said, no. And I'm starting to get like frustrated with him because I know he's playing a game, right, with me. But ultimately he said, oh, well then how did you do it? And so of course I tell the story that we all have, right? You get on the bike, you get a little bit of instruction like how to do it, but then you have to actually try to do it. And you fall down and you hurt yourself maybe, or you just get frustrated. It's like, okay, what went wrong? Let me try again. Let me take what I learned, get a little bit of coaching. Let's do it again. And he said, it's so simple when we think about riding a bike. Why is it so hard when it comes to teaching and learning? That we assume students should just learn, and then they can go out in the real world and do it. How about we actually get them to do it and see where they make mistakes or what they don't understand, and then coach them up and then let them try it again. Like, that's how the world works. But somehow we haven't figured that out as a system. So to get back to your question, CAPS is about getting the students out, fast forwarding them past high school, past college. It's usually a supplemental experience to their traditional high school experience. So it could be embedded in a high school. It could also be like a center-based program that happens for half of a school day where students come to a different environment and they get into this position where they feel like they are, you know, entry-level professionals, and they go out and they take the 10th thing on the to-do list off of an industry partner's plate. And they spend, you know, somewhere between 2 weeks and 6 weeks, sometimes longer, working on that project to bring back deliverables. So it could be, and there's all kinds of examples, right? If it's an engineering company, it might be build a prototype for this, right? Or give us a fix for something that's caught up in our works and we can't seem to figure it out. Give us some ideas how to fix that. It could be in business, marketing strategy, or a competitor analysis, or a data analytics project. Like, here's our data and we don't know what we don't know. Like, help us see what anomalies may be here or what you see when you look at this data. And that becomes a presentation back. If it's a media class, it could be new logo designs for our company or a nonprofit, or it could be, we need to completely redesign the look of our website to attract Generation Z. Like, perfect. Who better knows that than our high school students? So give them real work, let them get after it. They obviously learn along the way. And quite honestly, oftentimes they produce real value, and it becomes an amazing partnership between the industry partner and the students.
Why hasn't community and schools connected? What's going on there? I mean, it's a market gap, right? Like, yeah. I mean, we've talked to a lot of different people around CTE on this. I just want to pick your brain on that. Like, what's happening? Why is this common sense thing not happening? And Ali, in our previous conversations, and I think Corey is as well, I'm not patient, man. I'm like, let's go. But, yeah. You know, it takes time, obviously, when you're dealing with these things. But, you know, what are the roadblocks that you see and that you've actually kind of worked through with maybe some examples?
For sure. That's a great question. And it's funny you say that about not being patient. I would agree. I'm in the same boat. In fact, there's a exercise that people have done for a long, long time. It's kind of an ancient practice, but I got connected to this thing called white stone ceremonies, where you take a stone and you write a word. You basically sit in some kind of silence or peace, whatever that is for you, meditation, perhaps. You just give yourself mental space, and you see, usually it happens like the beginning of a year, like new year, new focus, and what word comes to you. And I actually have this sitting right in front of me. It's funny you say that. I got my white stone that a few years back with patience, and don't have a lot of it. Funny enough, the next year it was spark, meaning I'm patient, I'm not done being patient. I'm going to spark something now. I think the biggest my belief is the biggest gap, part of that gap is we have, for years and years and years, you have this silo effect. When you get involved, you know, you go to college, university, you think about what it is you want to do with your career, everything siloed by major and then eventually certification. You kind of get thrown out into the world, and, you know, this is getting better, but the ability for people to pivot between some of these industry lanes and education, you know, traditionally it's been pretty darn hard to do that. You've had to go through, okay, I want to get back in education. I've been out in industry. I've got to go through some kind of alternative certification. It's going to involve me going to grad school at night and on weekends. And I've got to make up like 2 years worth of this. And it's going to cost me this much money to make that big honking paycheck that you make in education, right? It'll take care of all that. Obviously being sarcastic. So that's a pretty big barrier to overcome. And so, and then those that stay in the lanes. So let's say I've always known I wanted to be a teacher. And so I am, you know, typically pretty good at school because I want to stay in the school system. It's been good to me. I go to university. I'm thinking about staying in school. I'm learning in another school through the post-secondary institution. I get out. I go student teach in a school. And now my work is the school. Like, I have never left education. Mm-hmm. And it was actually shocking to me when I got into education, how fearful educators, and not all, but I'm not trying to stereotype here, but by and large, how fearful educators are to interact with industry partners. Mm-hmm. It's like they don't know how to do it. They've never had to do it. I've never had to go to a happy hour and, like, you know, have a beer with someone that works in the insurance industry and, like, chit chat with them.
Right.
And I really don't know how to ask them for something because I feel like I'm somehow putting a burden in their lap and it doesn't feel good. And I don't yet understand this idea of, like, no, you go for these win-win opportunities, right? If you've been in business, you get that because it's part of your MO. And similarly, people who have always been in business since being in school, one, they see education the way they had education, mm-hmm. which could be decades removed, even though a lot of it's still the same. They see it that way, but they don't know. They've had no real interaction with the school other than, like, whatever their kids are up to, like, right. Showing up to the parent teacher night or some kind of a showcase or what have you. They've not been involved in a lot of conversations with school leadership about how do we partner. And so the language is different. It feels like an eighth grade dance, if I'm being honest. It's just it's super awkward. So I think part of the challenge is how do we lean in where we're seeing more of this traction of industry partners getting quicker certifications to teach, which is happening. It's state by state, so that is a little frustrating. But you're getting more of that. You've definitely got wind at the back of career-connected learning right now in the ecosystem, so that's helpful. And you have a labor shortage, which is driving more employers to be curious about what it would mean to partner with schools. They also are not patient. So sometimes it's a challenge to get them down to the high school level, but we're seeing traction there too. So I think we're going to get there. It's just, we need to continue to talk about it and we need to encourage educators to reach out. We need to give them toolkits to do so. So it doesn't feel as, icky to them, I guess. I don't know what the right word is. To make it a little more comfortable for them.
Right.
And on the industry side, we need to encourage them and hold up examples of real value to industry partners to help them move from, well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't know how it would work, to, oh, I've actually seen some examples now of how this could work. How do we get started?
The language barrier between industry and education has certainly been evident since I have left the classroom, and just like there's a learning curve there. So with your analogy with the eighth grade dance and it being like awkward and, you know, in the siloing of education, not only like, you know, most people going through the system, you know, they get put on a track and that's like where they go, and that choice could have decades of impact on someone's life. And But I like that you also pointed out that many people in the educational system have not, like, they themselves have siloed themselves and basically been in the system for a long, long time and don't understand that, like, all of these opportunities are even available. Because I remember when we talked to Nate Clayburgh, this was at the beginning of 2023 when we had this conversation, and the program that he's running in one of the Cedar, Iowa.
Cedar Falls.
Don't make the wrong one.
Yeah, don't do that. You'll get in trouble.
Cedar Falls. It's one of the Cedars. I got you.
Cedar
Falls in Iowa. And it's like, wow, like there are these opportunities and amazing economic benefits. And Peter and I have gone on this exploration over the past year of just all these different programs that can kind of happen. So from a Generation Z and Generation Alpha, right, we've got these students that could potentially, and even you see in the millennial generation of, you know, I don't want to make a decision that pigeonholes me and silos me for 10, 20 years. I want to kind of get a better sense before I even start. Is this really for me? And then if it isn't, I don't want to be stuck in it. So like how it's almost like gamifying school a little bit, but like when you talk about, you know, like pathways, what have you seen with students, you know, of them like maybe exploring something and realizing, wow, I never would have thought of this and I really like it. Or thank goodness, I really thought this was the pathway for me. And now I know that that is not the way I want to pursue. And I just saved myself potentially 4 years of undergraduate or more to go down a road that I really wouldn't have even enjoyed.
Yeah, that's very well said. And I think it's a really key point. I don't know if you're trying to make a point, but I see the point in my mind, which is it's critical that students, if we're going to go where students lead, and we truly believe that, and we want to empower that feeling, it behooves us, and it's really important for us to ensure that what we build has legitimate on-ramps and off-ramps that are easy to access. And I will say this, and there are a lot of pathway models, academy models, and I think in general, those programs are great because you're giving students opportunities to connect to something that's real and authentic. And I think that's really, really important. And for a lot of students, a lot of kids, a lot of young adults, young professionals, you know, they get into something that they really enjoy and that they see the power, and they say, hey, I thought I wanted to do this. I validated it. And now I can really go deep with it. And that's fantastic. And at the same time, you're going to have students, it may be as many as half or more, that get involved in something and have an aha moment. They go through a self-discovery process. They try some things out and then they realize, oh no, or oh crap, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. This doesn't feel like something I want to do. And in our minds, you know, the CAPS mindset around that is fantastic. Like, we celebrate that. You've just ruled something out and you've made your future choice kind of window a bit smaller, which allows you to avoid these wild pivots. You know, when you get into really wild pivots in your life where you go from one extreme to the other, what feels like that, that creates a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that can be detrimental. But if you can narrow that window, that's a positive. And so one of the challenges with a more structured and longer run academy or pathway model is there one, a reality of off-ramp and then another on-ramp where I as a student can see that I can make a choice and then I can make a, you know, I can change or I can pivot. Mm. But the second thing, which is also just as important, is even if it's a reality that you can make a change, is the perception of the student and how they're going to feel about making the change going to allow them or encourage them to change when they have the self-discovery? Or are they going to feel, even though they have the option, they're going to feel locked into where they are? And I'll give this example. There are, and again, I'm not knocking this as a as a model, because in some places this just makes sense financially from efficiency standpoint, transportation, all of this. But there are some districts that will have like, this high school is for these pathways. Mm-hmm. And then we have this high school that's for these pathways. And we have this high school that's for these. And they're asking eighth grade students to choose the high school that has the pathway that they're interested mm-hmm. in. And that will be their high school. So as an eighth grader, you only know what you know, and you don't know what you don't know. And so you get to that school. Let's say I think medicine helps for me. And so I go to the high school. It happens to be a little bit across the community. I go in, I get in the freshman year, and it's some basic stuff, and I'm meeting and making friends and all the good stuff that happens in high school beyond academics. And I enjoy that. I've got my clan and all that good stuff. I get to sophomore year, a little more application, and I'm like, oh no, I do not want to do this. Oh, district says, that's okay. We can send you across town to that other high school if you want to try the environmental science program. I now have to make a choice with my friend group that I've established, my school, the sports teams I'm on, the extracurriculars, and what I think I want to do with my life. And I don't think that's a fair choice for kids. Again, this is just me talking. I'm not speaking for CAPS. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the challenges. And so one of the things I really enjoy about the way we've built our model, and a little bit of it was just through trial and error, and there's some luck involved in all of this, of course, but it's we have erred on the side of self-discovery over like prerequisites and drilling people deep into pathways with CAPS. Our belief is that regardless of your background of academic experience, if you have the curiosity and the passion for something that you see, whether you make that discovery as an eighth grader or a freshman in high school, or even like first semester senior year, we should give you a chance to hop into that industry. And even if you're starting from the very beginning, work on something real and authentic as a project so you can at least start to test it out. Mm-hmm. That's more important to us than have you had five prereqs to go into the super deep 400 level bioscience class.
Right.
Right or wrong. That's where we put our bias.
So with what's going on in my state, is, you know, and you literally just described what legislation is pushing on the opposite way a little bit of what CAPS is all about, right? There's a challenge there. Mm-hmm. The earlier you can get the pathway started, actually there is a golden nugget for the schools, right? There's a little bit more cash, da da da, all this stuff. Obviously, you know, with the on-ramps and off-ramps, and I like that because, you know, that's what I want for my own children, right? I want them to experience the best I do right now, because we do not have the program at their high school, but we let them know, take as many as electives, and then if you hit one, go, but there's also limited choices, but just get out there and go. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, have you worked with state government boards of education? And if so, like, what was that like? And then I also want to kind of back that up with, is it possible to pull like, and I know we're all three of us are fans of the durable skills, yes, to pull durable skills into that conversation about grants and monies around students showing those? Which I know, you know, America Succeeds is building that as well and such. So kind of a two-part question there. Throwing a lot at you right now, but what the heck?
What the heck? Why not?
Yeah, what do you think about, first off, you know, the pathways and the challenges and how to work? Have you worked with governments, boards? And then, you know, what are your thoughts on durable skills kind of replacing the track?
I love that idea. Anything we can do to encourage and incentivize the experience for students in K-12, and I think start with in particular 9-12, because it's that exit point is so important to have those durable skills. Mm-hmm. And the employers all tell us that's what we want.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't teach them a darn technical thing, we can teach them a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't have the capacity, and quite honestly, back to the word of the episode here, patience. We don't have the patience to have to teach all of our new hires how to show up on time and manage a project and work in a team. Like, we have to assume you can do that. We'll teach you the technical stuff, at least, you know, the more specific things for our industry, because we all do it differently. And so we'll teach that. So I really like that frame. As far as like where we've been, we have not, although this is, I think, going to change here in the near future, we have not spent a lot of time in the policy space, and in particular going to state boards and getting into conversations there related to, you know, how do you allocate funding? How, you know, what are the standards that you're, you know, emphasizing, and does that need to change? We just haven't, as an organization. We're a small nonprofit, even though we have a kind of a mighty field team. If you think about the 104 affiliate programs that are part of the CAPS network, so those are all programs operating the CAPS model. The core team is small, so we haven't had the bandwidth really to go there. But I do think there's an appetite to partner with some others in the ecosystem, and America Succeeds would be one of them. Mm-hmm. There are others that I think we can band together and start having that, what I would call the top-down conversation.
Yep.
We spend a lot of time in the grassroots, like, where's the energy and how can we energize local districts, programs to lift up and to kind of do the thing they want to do where they are. Now, what I'll say to that is, we often see where we're working in a district that has a more rigid pathway model that might have been incentivized by the state. Sometimes the districts just decide they want to do that themselves. Mm-hmm. We have actually, in multiple places, paired a pathway model with CAPS. And what tends to happen is the pathway is how you get started in your exploration. You start kind of going from the freshman year up through those lanes. When you kind of navigate your way through, however that's done within that district, that all kind of sorts itself out. And then CAPS is laid on top as almost like the capstone project time based on what you learned in your first 2 or 3 years of being in the pathway. And that can work really well. It does mean you've got to be intentional about how you let students maneuver the first 3 years, so it's not feeling like I'm just locked in and that's it.
Right.
But we've seen that work really well with like a Forward Next Generation Learning model, for example, where we partnered that up. So that's definitely possible. And yeah, it'll be interesting. We're so fragmented as an industry. I mean, there are 50 state governments that all, you know, it's a locally controlled school model in the country. You have over 13,000 public school districts that are answering to 50 different states that all have different standards, different things they're incentivizing. The last calculation I made, just back of the envelope for my own purposes, was if you look at the number of people that could influence decision making to bring in a model or to say this is the way we're going to do it in our own district, you're over 100,000 decision makers easily. So to get like sweeping change to happen, you have to have some top down. Even then, like I said, it's 50 different states, and the U.S. Department of Ed can try to encourage certain actions, but they have a limited authority level. So, which I think is the way it should be, but it makes it hard to scale across the country. So we're going to have to be smart about how we do it. But I think you lean into where the incentives currently are. You look for ways to partner with what's already being done, and you try to play in the gray a little bit. When people have seen things as always black and white, how can you meet the marks that are necessary for that state to have this career connected learning, but show a way it can be done that's a little bit different? And I think that can encourage more people to participate.
I don't think we've had a guest paint as clear of a picture of the importance of the local community and, you know, empowering how much power you can have with a smaller group of decision makers. Because we have conversations all the time about, you know, do you go from kind of the grassroots up and find what's best for, you know, yourself locally, or do you try and go from more of a top down sweeping change, either state or federal? And while it's like awesome to think about, yes, we could really reimagine school at, you know, a countrywide level, I think especially in a CAPS type model, you're really looking at, I'm going to assume, local partnerships and local businesses as much as possible. I mean, I would think they'd have the most buy-in. They'd have the most opportunity to kind of have real change and get people who have grown up there to potentially stay there and work there and live there and, like, you know, have it thrive. So I'm curious, in term, you said you've been doing this for 9 years. What kind of transformations have you seen, you know, locally with this type of model, and, you know, either specific to where you're at or with one of the 104 affiliate network models?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you nailed it. The impact and the reason that it's so important to go local with this is you have to have a co-ownership feeling to the work. We strongly believe in that. And what that means is we're not just creating a package of curriculum or here's exactly how you do this, follow this manual A to triple Z, and boom, you got CAPS. The problem with that, I mean, there's lots of problems with that. One, the world doesn't work linearly like that. Two, how inspired is an educator going to be to just pick up a manual and say, I'm just going to march through these steps? Like, that's not inspiring at all. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to create something dynamic, you need local flavor. You need to feel like you have the space to innovate yourself. You know, it's helpful to have frameworks. It's helpful to have some core values to kind of root what you're doing. But ultimately, the vision, there has to be a local vision. Otherwise, it's not going to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be that spirit. It's a spirit of entrepreneurship. It's a spirit of awakening and tapping into, you know, the potential of young people and all that they bring to the table. It's a creative space. And when you're creating and innovating and being curious, it's going to color outside the lines, right? The crayon's not going to stay inside the lines. And that's where we learn. That's where we find that gray area to innovate and to try new things. So it's absolutely essential. And, you know, back to the idea of, okay, how do we truly leverage to make some change to where states are incentivizing things like CAPS, or we're seeing more kind of push to make it easier based on all the checkboxes we've got to make in whatever state we're in or with whatever other policy we've got to meet. I do, my vision or visual for it, it's not unique to me or what have you, but I always think of it as like, you've got to create the sandwich. Like, you can build the grassroots support, and that's kind of like the bottom piece of bread and all the, you know, the peanut butter and all that kind of stuff that you're lifting up. And that's amazing. And I would say always start bottom up, right? Start from the bottom, because that's where you're in locally controlled schools. You've got the business partners that are going to be most apt to work in their own community, at the schools where their kids are going. So tap into that energy and get the early adopters and start doing some things. Easiest to experiment at the smallest level, right? Find a classroom, find a school. Don't have to launch a program that goes to every single student across a 30,000 student district right away. Get started small, start small, experiment. You build that up, but then at some point, if you truly want to scale, you've got to close the sandwich. And that means you're bringing the grassroots up, but you're also bringing the policy, the incentivization, and removing the barriers. That has to come at some point with some top-down activity. But I think just coming straight at the top down without the grassroots, you're going to end up with something that a lot of people are not going to like, because it's going to feel forced. It's going to feel like a mandate, right?
Yep.
I don't care where you sit on the spectrum. Like, no one likes that feeling. You want to feel like you're part of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So bring that first and then close the sandwich. And my hope is we'll get enough of this grassroots activity going that we can start to close the sandwich here in the next few years.
I'm sure of it. We have a lot of listeners that are the bottom bread of the sandwich, I should say. So
yeah.
Before we grab your information and how people can connect, what's coming up? What's coming up, and what are some highlights you have for 2024?
Yeah, incredibly excited about 2024. A big one, which some of your listeners may be interested in, is we're going to be convening a group of very disruptive innovators, many of which are part of the CAPS network, but not all of them are. We do this every summer and super excited for what we call the CAPS Summer Huddle. It's going to happen last week of June in 2024. So I think June 24th through the 26th. We're going to be convening in Kansas City this year. Expect about 300 of your closest friends that you've never met to be there, to have a lot of networking time and to share what their work, what everyone's working on, and to find ways to support each other. And so that's incredibly exciting. We have information on our website and registration is open. If anyone's interested in joining us, we would absolutely love to have you. If you're listening to this podcast, you're enough like us that we will enjoy time together, right? So that's coming up. We released a few months ago an alumni impact report, which I think if you're interested in like having some ammunition when you go to policymakers, when you go to other influencers, and you're in this kind of experiential learning space, but you're looking for data as to why it's important. We've got over 1,000 former CAPS students that have answered 15 minutes worth of questions for us, and we've teased out a lot of data about where they are now and what was important to them. That's also available on our website. Which is, I should probably say, yourcapsnetwork.org, yourcapsnetwork.org. And that's all free to access if you navigate the site. So that's two exciting things. And then we're always into just some fun stuff. You know, we got some real like day long, we call them hack events, where we get students together either in person or virtually. And we bring in a CEO of a company and they say, this is the thing that I just can't seem to figure out, or my board has challenged me to figure out. What are your ideas? And we just get them in teams and they get after it. We're going to do three of those this spring. A couple of them are more like localized to Kansas City. We've got one that's going to be virtual, where we're going to have students piping in from across the country. So just a lot of fun things going on. And I mean, we're working some other projects as well. Maybe the one last one I'll mention just as a teaser for something that we hope will be starting to release this summer and into the fall and then the next year, to this point of like, how do we bridge the gap between the communication of the industry partner and the educator? Mm-hmm. We're in a project right now that we have funded through a philanthropic organization that's going to allow us to build an industry partner story campaign, where essentially we're going to get on film industry partners that have worked with high school students talking to other industry partners about why they should be involved doing something similar. Nice. And the idea is, if I'm an educator and I'm really uncomfortable like bringing this up or like explaining how this could work to an industry partner in my community, let's make it easier and say, send this pack of three videos or whatever it ends up being, right? Send these things over to the industry partner in your community and say, watch these videos from your peers in other parts of the country, and then let's talk.
Yeah.
About what you heard and what you might want to do, and kind of take the pressure off the educators. So, and that's intended to be an open source resource. So when we have that available, we'll be sure to let you know. Might be useful to some of your educator followers here on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Allie, final thoughts.
I mean, Corey really hit the peanut butter part of that sandwich with, you got the bread, you started it, but now it is kind of getting you're kind of making it sticky and easy to put the other slice of bread on there with these resources. And I love that CAPS is really trying to make it accessible and easy for it to grow. Cause I think even educators and people who are wanting to disrupt the system, they don't know what they don't know. And it can feel really challenging and like they're in a silo. Yeah. And so we love having conversations like these that can kind of help people see themselves and see opportunities where they otherwise wouldn't. So thank you for the work that you do with CAPS and for being on here. And just like, we always love learning about these awesome organizations and partnerships and different ways to do school, because it doesn't have to be this one track. You make a decision in eighth grade and you're stuck on it until
for sure.
You're 40.
Five million paleontologists.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, right. Doesn't know that nothing matches up. If you don't mind, one last nugget, because sure. I think this might be a small thing that could unlock, you know, if you've got people listening that are in systems or in schools and they're just like, I can't seem to get anything to move. My advice would be focus on three things. And this is for teachers and students, quite honestly. Awareness, mm-hmm. permission, and time. Those are barriers. The awareness of how this can work and the power of something that connects out to the real world is incredibly important. And it's not terribly hard these days to like do that, but you've got to be intentional about it. Mm-hmm. Permission, meaning if I have a level of authority in a school, a principal, for example, how do I ensure that I have given my teachers permission to try some new things or to get out into the community? Because oftentimes the assumption is I don't have permission. Mm-hmm. So make sure it's explicit that there's permission and repeat it so that it's very clear that I, you know, I'm encouraging you to do this. And then get creative with time. Time is always a barrier for educators. Mm-hmm. So can you take certain things off of a plate of a set of teachers or your teaching staff that's always been seen as something we have to do or it's a regimented thing that we do? That frees up a little bit of time for teachers to actually go out and make these connections with industry, with others in the community, to attend a chamber, you know, happy hour or whatever it is. You know, sometimes you've got to structure that time. Otherwise, teachers are overwhelmed and it's like, I don't have time. And then it won't happen, even if they want to do it.
Well said. I like those three: awareness, permission, and time, although I ask for forgiveness a lot, but you know, that's because I created a Disrupt Education podcast. So, you know,
what is it? Seek forgiveness later, not permission to start. Right.
Well, the website is yourcapsnetwork.org. If you look up Corey, you're on LinkedIn as well, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Got it.
Look me up and reach out and let me know how I can help.
Will do. Appreciate your time and taking some time away to give us the info and a few stories and actually your own story. And thank you for being lost for a while and finding your way to this awesome organization. No, we always appreciate disruptors, and you definitely are. So again, head over to yourcapsnetwork.org if you want to check that out. A lot of amazing things. We're going to end this one here. For Allie Privet and Corey Moan, I'm Peter Hostrasser. Thank you guys. Thank you everyone for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Disrupt Education Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Disrupt Education Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Are you ready to disrupt the educational arena you're a part of? For more ways to get involved in the work we do here at Disrupt Education, check us out at disrupteducation.co. Or find us on LinkedIn at Peter Hostrasser or Allie Privet.
Our mission here is to help facilitate and amplify changes in the educational system through local initiatives and help you scale them into community movements. Our building network of disruptors in education are working to move beyond scores and grades as the only measure for student learning. If your school district, college campus, or organization is looking for facilitators of this work, reach out on our website or social media.
And if you have any thoughts or feedback on this week's episode or any episode, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries, taking risks, and most importantly, disrupting education.